That's the Soul Jazz Orchestra from deep in the heart of Ottawa, Canada, with People, People. That's from their 2008 album, Manifesto. This is Lead Stories. I'm Beatrice Lead. It is Thursday, June the 26th, and we pick up our discussion from where we left off just yesterday, and we're talking about the Central Park 7, not the 5, but the 7. We're talking about what's behind the legal lynching of the Central Park 7. Our guest is attorney at law, or known in the community also as the People's Attorney General, Alton H. Maddox Jr., who has spent more than 4 decades in the trenches, confronting systems of power in behalf of people who are politically and legally unprotected. And he has paid a great price for that, coming after one of the most spectacular trials, and it is the longest lasting trial in his career, that of representing Tuana Brawley. And because of his vigorous representation, and because of his just his confrontations with the powers that be, there was a conspiracy to bar him completely illegally. This has not happened in the history of the United States, where a state legislature voted to take action to bar him from the courtrooms of the state of New York. It is an unprecedented thing. Of course, he still is battling that, but he addressed that yesterday by making an announcement that he will be returning to the courtroom. And I can tell you, because I've followed the Alton Maddox's career for many years, many, many years, and I can tell you without any hesitancy that the community, not just in the state of New York, but the community, the African-American community in particular, has been without extraordinarily competent representation because of his absence from the courtrooms. I want to thank you again, Alton, for joining us today.
The Invitation to Trees.
Okay. Well, let's pick up on this question. So many cases that you have been involved in have essentially focused on the corruption, on the misconduct of police, of prosecutors, and even of judges. What could you say? People would say, well, that's not a normal thing. This is an exception. It may happen from time to time, but it is more an exception rather than the rule. What has your experience been?
Well, I think it's not so much what you hear about in the courtroom. It's what you don't hear about. And I really think we need to focus on that to answer the question that you just posed. When you go in a courtroom, you're always going to hear a hearsay objection. You're always going to hear an objection of opinion, evidence. You're going to always hear objections about irrelevancy. And it gets go on and on as to the various objections that lawyers can and do raise. The one objection that you never hear, and this actually explains the question that you pose, you never hear an objection to habit evidence. In fact, most people may never heard of the notion of habit evidence. And what that is that the system acts habitually without notice, without reflection, without any understanding. It just answers everything habitually. That can be very dangerous to people of African ancestry because the habit with us started over 400 years ago, and it has continued. And so even though the judges' names may change, but the habit that they have incurred and inherited still exists. And that is the one area in which it's hard to get a handle on. You know, how do you really make that objection? Because you can't object to it prematurely, and you can't really object to it after the fact because sometimes it has already been done, the damage has been done, and so there's no real cure. The problem is that slavery itself has actually shaped the rights that we have as a people. Slavery has. And it can't be undone. So, you know, you can look at the 13th Amendment in 1865, or you can look at the 14th Amendment in 1868, or you can look at the 15th Amendment in 1870. None of those amendments can change what Judge Taney made as official in 1857 when he had to decide the question of whether there was a real difference between free blacks and enslaved Africans. And that was really the question. And the question arose, and I think this is very significant, because I'll be going to understand, you know, your personal opinions don't mean anything. They're totally irrelevant. So, you know, you hear somebody say, well, you know, I think this, I think that. That's not relevant. What is relevant is the rules that have existed and still existed in American jurisprudence. That's what's relevant. And so if you're not aware of the history, you're not aware of the ethics, you're not aware of the logic, and you're not aware of the philosophy, what you actually believe otherwise is totally irrelevant. So you got to first get in the moment when you make your stuff relevant, and when you talk about things that are beyond or under the moment, it's just totally irrelevant. So what Taney said was, is that no Negro has any rights that whites are bound to respect. And that became the actual law. Now, that was 1857. Then you had a civil war, and you had constitutional amendments, 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. And then you had the whole period of Reconstruction. And at the end of Reconstruction, what Taney said was significant. no Negro has any rights that whites are bound to respect. So, you know, now we've lived through all this period. We've seen Sean Bell. We've seen Amadou Diallo. You know, we've seen the Central Park 7, the Scottsboro Boys case. We've seen my legal lynching and all these other things that are still happening. And they're happening because of habit, because of habit evidence. And the legal forums have failed to address how do you deal with habit evidence. And so, for example, in 1991, there was a Blue Ribbon Commission made up by definition of the outstanding people in the community. You know, because you can't have a Blue Ribbon Commission unless you have blue ribbons. And these are people who are noted for being outstanding in the community. And when Judge Wadler summoned this commission and impaneled this commission after he had been under attack himself, because people had realized if you go back into the public record, you're going to see a lot of complaints from me. And I may have been the chief contributor to Wadler having to do what he did. And therefore, this Blue Ribbon Commission examined the New York judicial system, and it came to a conclusion that has never been repeated by any black elected official or any leading black in New York. And that conclusion it was that New York's judicial system is infested with racism. Is infested. People need to, maybe we don't understand what the word infested means, or maybe we don't understand what the word Blue Ribbon Commission means, but for a Blue Ribbon Commission to reach the conclusion that the legal system in this state is infested with racism should be a great alarm to black people. And, you know, and the reality of it is, other than maybe myself, you know, this has not been repeated. So, you know, we have to first of all go back and examine ourselves, because here the Blue Ribbon Commission said that it is infested with racism, and the racism continues because of habit, because of habits, because people, I don't care what the time of day is on the calendar, people still see us as slaves. You can go out in the street right now and confront a police officer in New York, and they still see you as slaves. Now, you may want to see yourself as whatever. You know, you may want to see yourself as the Queen of England, the King of England, the King of France, or whatever the case might be. But that's not what they see. You know, and that's what you got to begin to address. We are hallucinating by thinking that we are something other than what other people see us as.
Now, that is a really interesting thing, because that, too, you have had to repeatedly confront in many of the cases that you have handled, and you've handled very, very controversial cases.
Right.
They've always been about this elemental philosophy that informed the conduct of the police in investigating these cases, in the conduct of the prosecutor in these cases, and the conduct even of the judges in these cases. A 58-page document was presented to show that the trial of the Central Park Five, as they call them now, these specific five young men, was a sham. I mean, there was an actual report done that said it was a sham. And to this day, the DA's office has not been called to account. The prosecutor has not been called to account. The judge has not been. Nobody, the investigating detectives, nobody has been called to account. And this was a more high profile. This was a very high profile case. And you could imagine how often this very same attitude prevails in cases that are not as high profile.
No, and you're absolutely right when you say that's what they said. But I would like to add something to that. When I first got involved in the case, I announced then it was a hoax. You know, and I said then, well, there's no reason for us to sit here and wait on any discovery. There's no reason for us to sit here and wait on any motions that have to be made. If this is a hoax, and I maintain that it is, it's a sham, that these young men are innocent right from the beginning. And, you know, and the Fourth Estate, you know, jumped on me, you know, like white on rice, saying that, you know, I was absolutely out of my mind. How could I be insensitive to a white woman who has been raped by a wolf pack? You know, and then I'm calling for that wolf pack to be free. And, you know, so they went after me just for saying that. But, you know, the instinct that I had right from the beginning was that this did not happen in the way that this state was trying to persuade people that did happen. But I did know from a historical basis that when whites seek blood, they don't care which blood it comes from. You know, the only thing we want to do is get some blood and spill it all over the place, and then we are done. And so, you know, that's why I had the real problem right from the beginning, because I couldn't see what everybody else saw, and I really saw a lynching. And it's sad that we're talking about 20-some years later that we finally being able to at least admit on a very limited scale now that something happened, because actually these young boys and the settlement of their case does not in the case itself. And you know, when I say that a lot of black selected officials, leading blacks, you know, they are taking the position that, well, okay, we can wash our hands of this. No, you can only wash your hands of anything when the law says you have to wash your hands. See, that's the point that we miss. You have to begin to use the very law that they wrote against them. And so when it relates to white people, after there has been a full settlement, you know, not just hush money, when there has been a full settlement, and after that it calls for legislation. And the legislation is to look at the legal system and make sure that that does not happen again. Now, we are ready to fold the tent now. You know, $40 million. Take the money and run. That's why we had to go back and revisit this all the time, because we never settle anything. The law has not said that this case has been settled. The law has simply said that five young men got a certain sum of hush money. All right, that's not settlement of a case. And when you do finally admit that everybody has been made whole, that means all of the young men who were arrested that night, who were brought into questioning, who were subject to detention, all of those young men will have to first have their cases settled before the issue has been resolved on the first level. And so, you know, this is where we are now. We're trying to bring our people to the point of understanding that, you know, this is about a process. And you can't keep complaining about your being victimized when you are turning around and financing your own oppression. And that's what we are doing. We are endorsing and financing our own oppression, because when they tell us, like they tell dogs, to shut up and be quiet, then we automatically closing our mouths. That doesn't resolve any issues. You got to be able to think beyond that and go for the idea that, you know, first of all, if all of these young men have not been compensated, then we have to go back to the New York legislature and amend the statute of limitations to especially allow all of the young men who were damaged to come forward and to be compensated first. And then after that, we need to hold a grand jury investigation and determine who the culprits are and what their criminal liability is, and then issue a report after the grand jury has made those indictments. Well, that's the way you really resolve a problem. And so we're a long ways from resolving this issue by any stretch of the imagination. Now, after we have given notice, you know, you and I and others have talked about this on the airways and all of that. Now, black people want to go back and go to sleep. That's their business. But if they want to protect their children, protect generations yet to be born, then we got a long ways to go.
One cannot help but note that this case dramatically resembles another case, the case of Tawana Brawley that you handled.
Mm-hmm.
And yet the treatment of these cases couldn't be more stark. Could you
right.
talk about how this case basically illustrates the duality of justice?
Yeah, well, you
for
see, this,
when the right. when the victim of a crime is a white female and the perpetrators are people of color, African American, Latino, as opposed to the case of Tawana Brawley. Here is an African American teenager, and the her victimizers were all white men. So, Ruby, could you tell us, because you were involved in both cases, could you tell us how we ought to interpret this and how you interpret the cases themselves?
Okay, well, this is the explanation for that disparity, you know, that you are citing now. And the explanation really comes after some real deep understanding of the law itself. Now, you know, yesterday when we left out, you said, well, do you have any question that you want to raise for tomorrow? And I left it by saying, well, you, Treece, no, you know, you can go back and do your homework and blah, blah, blah. Now, the reality of it is I was wrong or a little bit deceptive because, see, you had actually hit the nail on the head. At that particular moment, I didn't want to answer the question because I didn't think we had laid enough of a foundation. But, you know, the real problem comes about in these cases is the fact that lawyers are systematically and routinely and by definition guilty of legal malpractice. And, you know, and that's the problem that you have because virtually 99% of all lawyers are not fit to be practicing law. And, you know, and you said that yesterday when you asked the question, you know, about the attorneys. I didn't want to get into it then because I wanted to say some other things. I didn't think the audience was prepared to receive that at that particular time. But, you know, you can't ignore the fact that when you go back historically and you chart legal education in this country, and these things have to be done, you know, and you have to spend a lot of time doing these kinds of things in order to really understand it. Well, if you go back, what you do know is this. The first black lawyer in this country was admitted to the Maine bar in 1844, and that was Macon B. Allen. Now, in the meantime, there have been law schools that have been set up by Harvard and then William and Mary in Virginia in the early 1700s. So you're talking about 150 years in which white lawyers were totally not concerned about blacks at all because blacks were still in chains. And so who's going to give a black, a slave, in quotation marks, a trial or any protection of legal proceedings? Because this, we're talking about chattel slavery. Now, the best that you could do, well, how do you protect a slave master and not the slave? I mean, that's really the only question that could be raised. So now you got 150 years of developing a legal education in which we were in chains, and which they have set the basis for a legal education. And the lawyers who are being taught after 1844 are not being taught correctly in how to defend the black defendant. That's really the real issue. So therefore, you know, when we got to the Scottsboro Boys case in 1931, and we got to Central Park 7 in 1979. You still had a real problem here because none of these lawyers were taught how to defend the black defendant, and most lawyers could care less about learning how to represent the black defendant if, in fact, they have been given a law license, which is basically a money machine to make money. And so, you know, nobody has interest in really representing us at all. So every representation you see virtually is a sham and a charade. And that's really, you know, where it really starts. Now, to go back and to answer your question, we're trying to give that somewhat of a background. The answer is that we don't know how to read the law. All right, you know, and we don't carry around the U.S. Constitution, which is really the basis for many of the issues that affect us, and we don't understand the rationale behind the U.S. Constitution, which is a serious problem, and therefore we fail to realize that the Constitution itself has a duality of its own. And that duality, which we construe in understanding our rights, is the problem. And that duality is this. And I've been talking about this lately, you know, writing about it, trying to get us to understand some critical things about reasoning. And that duality is that the Constitution is made up of legal concepts. All right. So when you read about the right to bear arms, when you read about the right to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures, you know, you're talking about legal concepts. Now, where things go wrong is that blacks have been taught that those legal concepts also produce legal rules. And so, therefore, we are financing out and endorsing our own oppression. Because we look at a concept and find a legal rule, and then we hide behind the legal rule. You know, and I point some of these as examples when I note, for example, the right to bear arms is something that is widely discussed among all whites. But among blacks, that legal concept has been reduced to a legal rule by Negro leaders. And the legal rule is gun control, which is totally different than the right to bear arms. All right, and so therefore, you know, NRA, anytime there's any kind of wrinkle in the right to bear arms, they're up in arms, hollering and screaming and protesting and litigating and all of that. Whereas in the black community, it's just gun control. And so, you know, this is why these dualities really start, because of the way that we construe the Constitution itself and the way that we construe all other laws, by not being concerned about legal concepts and only being concerned about legal rules.
So how does in your experience as a litigator, mm-hmm. what do you note as being extraordinarily different with the Central Park case as opposed to the Brawley case, in terms of the way the system responded and treated both cases?
Well, you know, the way the system responded to both cases is in effect the answer in itself. There was no response to Warner Brawley other than a cover-up. I mean, really, once it hit the airwaves, then there was a law enforcement committee that was formed with the cooperation of Abrams and Rudolph Giuliani, where they put together law enforcement agents on that Monday after she was found on Saturday with a white woman. It would have been a manhunt from the beginning. You know, they would have been talking about, you know, let's set a committee of law enforcement agents. Let's talk about this. They would have been out, you know, scouring the community. I mean, somebody would have probably been behind bars, if not lynched, by Monday. And here you have, in Tawana Brawley, a group of law enforcement agents who were acting willingly or unwillingly with Steve Pagonis, one of the rapists, because we know from the testimony at the defamation trial, Steve Pagonis' girlfriend was a part of those people who were interviewing Tawana Brawley. So, you know, there was a cover-up that was happening right from the beginning. Now, in the Central Park 7 case, on the other hand, I mean, you had immediate arrest. I mean, they didn't wait till two or three days later. I mean, they were in Harlem all over the place. Sirens, cops, you know, everybody else screaming all over the place with canine dogs and everything else that they could get their hands on to try to find somebody. That didn't happen with Tawana Brawley. It did happen with the Central Park 7. And so after that happened, you know, there was no concern about did we get the right person? Hey, did we get anybody? There was a question. And the answer was, yeah, we got seven over here, and we'll railroad them and be through with this. This is the modus operandi of white supremacy. White supremacy is never interested in the truth. It's only interested in getting some black and brown bodies in to justify what they suggest will be the outcome. And so when somebody like me step up to the plate and say, wait a minute, you know, I'm not going for that. You know, I don't believe this. I'm going to conduct my own investigation, which is what happened to Tawana Brawley. And so when I finished my investigation, you know, I said, well, look, I'd have been up there, and I have found these suspects. I know who they are. You know, Steve Burgon is the one, Harry Chris is the other, several others the other. These are all the suspects. Well, you know, that's when the focus began to look at me then. Wait a minute, you causing problems. You know, you obstructing justice. You know, you got to be dealt with. I mean, so that's the difference in the modus operandi or the Central Park 7 on one hand and Tawana Brawley on the other.
How do we explain that in these cases, and the community has had so many high-profile cases to deal with that have the same chord, you know, whether it is the Amadou Diallo shooting, whether it is the Eleanor Bumpers case where, you know, they call in a psychiatrist who supposedly conducts an interview of her from the hallway and gives the SWAT team permission to just blow a 67-year-old woman away with a shotgun for no other reason than she was late with her rent. So, I mean, we've had all these cases, we could tick off any number of them, but they all have the same aspect to it, which is some kind of shady dealing at the precinct level or in the prosecutor's office or in the judge's chambers.
Mm-hmm.
So what has to happen for a major push to be made to say, you know what, we can't deal with this anymore. This is unacceptable. And at the same time, you know, the city is being overseen in the Central Park case. You know, we had the first African American mayor.
Right? Well, this is the whole point. Going back to the question that you asked initially, you know, we have further discussion later. But initially, it starts with one truism, and that is, those who fail to learn from the lessons of history are condemned to repeat them. I mean, that's a truism. And, you know, and I was back there with Eleanor Bumpers and, you know, certainly been there with Sean Bell, Amadou Diallo, and Central Park 7, and a whole host of others. But the fact of the matter is, we have never done what was required. We seem to be have dealt with insanity because insanity says that, you know, if you keep doing the same thing and expecting different results, you know, this is a telltale sign of insanity. And so, you know, what I'm saying now is, you know, we let this whole matter play out. Now we have the smoking guns, and it seems like if we want to bring this to an end, the time to do that is now and use these smoking guns to bring about a complete overhaul, if not a revolution, of the criminal justice system.
I want to talk about you specifically, and that is, you mentioned earlier that the system decided when you conducted, for example, your own investigation in the Brawley case, which was very extensive, I know that, I covered the case, you became a target because, in fact, the reason the state legislature gave for barring you from the courtroom was that you embarrassed, quote unquote, you embarrassed the state of New York by literally exposing so many wrongdoings at the same time. But of course, these were wrongdoings that the state was not at all willing to confess to. What in this case, let's talk about the Central Park 7 case, and that as a start, because these two cases were very close together, the Central Park case and the Brawley case.
Right.
Do you sense that there was a momentum from the Central Park case that culminated in an accelerated desire to have you removed from the legal scene?
Yes. Well, you know, one of the things that I think is important here, and I really have to, you know, to say, you know, in many ways, the wisdom of our ancestors seemed to have taken over in this case and set up his own timetable for its resolution and for us to act as a result of their wisdom. Now, the question is whether so many of us are still in the dark that we can't see how to act. But, you know, you're absolutely correct when you say that they were all intertwined. And what it did was it made white insanity real because, you know, the bottom line is if you look at these cases, the only thing that can explain how whites have been able to get away with it up to this point has been the notion of might makes right. I mean, that's the only way you can explain it. Might makes right, which is what was the notion in slavery itself. Might makes right. But if you go past might makes right and look into the logic of both of these cases, then might makes right don't stand up and they wither. The question is whether some of us are able to stand up to that or not. And, you know, and I will say this, and I think that a lot of times, you know, we see things and we brag about things, but we don't really understand the importance of the things that we are bragging about, you know. And I can go back, Utrice, and people who are listening to me know I'm not trying to brush your teeth or say anything, you know, beyond what is real. But when you were writing those editorials, people saw that as real, you know, and everybody was really enthusiastic. You know, it excited the community. It educated the community. The tragedy is nobody seemed to have ever understood the importance of what you were doing and how this has to be continuously embraced, and therefore, you know, what you were doing was right, or what the other people were doing was right, but we never, as a community, realized that, wait a minute, we gotta have this always. So, you know, when you left, you know, we didn't fill the void, and, you know, then you had the Amsterdam News, you know, and ultimately when Bill Tatum died, you didn't see nothing else there. Nobody came forward and said, wait a minute, you know, we have to have this editorial. That's what's really educating us and what's really exciting us. Because even when I was able to, you know, do a lot of things in the courtroom, I mean, people didn't really get excited until you actually wrote about it in the editorial. And it's amazing to me how we can get amnesia right off the bat. I mean, we can just, like, on instant notice, if there's a thunderstorm or some lighting, it just seems like everything goes out the window. And people just, okay, I don't remember that no more. I was hit by lightning. I was hit by a thunderstorm. You know, blah, blah, blah. And I don't remember that no more. And so what I'm saying is right there. I mean, it started with the kind of education that was being done in these editorials. It continued with the kind of absence of censorship that really affected our community and gave us the opportunity to really address these issues. Now, the issue now is how do we go back to that? Or can we restore our memories or refresh our recollections? Because that's become an issue now. Can black people understand how do you refresh somebody's recollection? Or how do you bring about something other than amnesia to begin to address these issues? But, you know, I can't take credit for things that are already there, things that have already been successful. The problem that we have now is that our people can't remember anything. You know, so you were back there in the City Sun, nobody remember that you were back there, nobody remember any editorials or nothing, or understand the importance of it. And so that's what we got to deal with. It seems like we're getting early dementia. And it
you know,
like
I do chuckle because, you know, just yesterday I saw a thing that says, no justice, no peace. And it, of course, is the watchword of a very interesting organization in Harlem.
Right, right.
It came right out of an editorial I wrote.
and you know, and what we don't understand is that this organization came about to promote gentrification. You know, so we don't even go in the background and say, well, why were they really formed? You know, what was the purpose about this organization being formed in the first place? And, you know, we don't go back to the public record because it's right there. It's not me making an accusation against some other person. I don't deal like that. I deal with the record itself. What is the public record? The public record is that this no justice, no jack, no peace was hijacked in order to serve as a cover for promoting the gentrification of Harlem.
We talked yesterday, and you announced yesterday, and I was quite stunned when you said it, and happy. I was doing a kind of happy dance in my heart, hearing you say that you are going to be back in it. You're having a meeting tonight. What are you going to be talking about, and where is it? And give us some idea what it is you're going to be announcing tonight to the community.
Well, you know, the organization behind the bench, which is actually doing something very worthwhile, and that is trying to establish law libraries in our various communities, is holding one of these forums tonight. And it just so happened that this particular forum is scheduled right at the time of this break in the Central Park 7. And so in my mind, I can only say, Utrice, I have been in New York for 40-some-odd years. This would have to be the most historic meeting tonight that we have ever witnessed. And, you know, unless you're just absolutely, totally disabled, it would be a real tragedy for you to say that you were not there. You know, because there are some events that you just have to be at. You know, and later on in life, it's going to come back, and people say, were you there? And then you're going to start lying and say, well, you know, I was, and I couldn't get in. You know what I mean? And those kind of things. So this is what is really getting ready to happen this evening at 5:30 at the Harlem Public Library on 124th Street between 5th Avenue and Malcolm X. Now, you know, the one thing about struggle is that you have to have your own timetable, or there must be a timetable that is structured. You know, and I say this, people who have attended a lot of my own lectures where, you know, we have these meetings, you know, I put in there various things that you got to have goals, you got to have timetables, you have to have a strategy, you got to have tactics. Well, I live by that, you know, but these are not something I'm just running my mouth about. I live by that. That's the only way you can really ever be successful if you want to succeed. That's become the question. Do you want to succeed, or do you just want to be a loud mouth or a rhetorician or whatever the case might be? But do you want to succeed? If you want to succeed, you got to have your own goals. Then you got to have your timetable. Now, I said a long time ago, because you see, Utrice, I knew from the day one that my ban from the practice of law was a hoax. I knew that. I mean, so, you know, but the question becomes, when do the community acquire that information? I mean, when do people who get up in the morning and say, you know what, These are the things that happened. Maddox was legally lynched by a court, and we haven't addressed that issue. So, to me, I already knew these things. The question becomes the timetable. Now, I have been one of those who have doggedly, embraced the notion of fighting for the Central Park 7. We've taken ass out. We have formed a freedom retreat for boys and girls to deal with it. So we've done a whole host of things that nobody else has done. That's just the record. I'm not bragging about it. It's sad, but that's the record. And nobody can refute the record. People can start lying about it. But these are a whole host of things that we've done with start a political party to begin to try to get legislation through and all that. These are things that are a matter of fact. Now, other people can lie about that they started the Freedom Party or they started this or that, but that's not the record. The record is that. So I already had realized that we had to put a timetable to all of this. And so we had to begin to put it together. Now, what I realized was that when they said I was suspended from the practice of law in 1990, it took 2 years for me to force the state of New York to say that we got to give this man a public hearing. Lawyers don't get public hearings. Lawyers don't want public hearings. Lawyers want to be able to do what they do against their clients and put it in undercover so nobody ever know really what they really did do. The first time that black people or anybody else, white or whoever, had ever been able to attend a public hearing from start to finish was the case of in the matter of Alton Maddox. All right, that was 2 years later. I insisted on it because what I wanted to do was to use that as an educational tool. So, and I got the largest courtroom. I said, I'm not going to deal with anything but the largest courtroom in Brooklyn. All right, so that seat over 400 people. I said, if we can't get the largest courtroom, then it won't happen. Because I want the largest number of people to say that they got an opportunity to see a legal lynching. And then I want to see how many of those people could recognize it as a legal lynching. So we did that. That's a matter of record. And so my point is that from there, do all these other things, form these various organizations. I call it a UAM conglomerate now because we have dealt with so many different subsidiaries that it is, in fact, a conglomerate. And so I wanted to do that, and I said to myself, when we finally get this settlement in the Central Park 7, I'm going to announce then that I'm going back into the practice of law. I'm not going to wait on white folks to tell me what I have a right to do. I was simply waiting for black people to have the mentality and the consciousness to be able to stand up. Because if you can't have acquired that at 24 years, then you're just deaf, dumb, and blind, and you run around with dead brain cells. I mean, so I wanted to make sure that we had all that. So this has happened now. Nobody could be happier for the old young man than I was. I agree with the fact that several victims have been denied access to the court and that we still got a lot of work to be done. But at least this is part of the first step. And part of that is I can prove, now I will prove, and people can see it and people who will be there tonight will know it, that I was absolutely framed and that I am not banned from the practice of law because you can't be banned if the court doesn't have jurisdiction over you in the first place. You see what I'm saying? So people say, well, the white man, he can't do nothing. Other than sit back and watch me try cases again, what else can he do? Because he didn't have jurisdiction in the first place. That's the first issue related to Tawana Brawley as it relates to me. Tawana Brawley should not be subject to the Full Faith and Credit Clause or the Fugitive Slave Act of 1851 and therefore not be able to work or to enjoy income. She should have to be able to do that because the New York courts never had jurisdiction over her. Never. You can't do anything unless you have jurisdiction. That's a basic requirement of law. And so, therefore, when they decided to go after me by saying that he won't cooperate with a grievance committee, and he won't cooperate because he won't tell us what we want to ask him of, the disciplinary committee at that point lost jurisdiction over me because, you see, the attorney-client privilege does not belong to the attorney. It belongs to the client. And so if you go to the client, as you should have done, and in this case it would have been Al Sharpton, if you had gone to Al Sharpton and said, Sharpton, we want you to waive the attorney-client privilege so that Maddox can testify against you, then that would have been the correct approach. But you can't come to me, the attorney, who has no privilege, because I don't own the privilege. Sharpton does, and say, well, we're going to investigate you and discipline you because Sharpton won't waive the privilege. That's hogwash. And that's all this case amounts to. So they never had jurisdiction over me. And so, you know, the moment I announced that I'm getting ready to practice law again is the moment of truth. And so, you know, I don't have no problem with that because these are very basic reasons for me to not just simply say, well, I'm going to start practicing law again. I decided to take that time off because of the fact that the community just seemed like they didn't understand what was going on. And so, you know, for the last umpteen years, I've been writing at my own expense to try to educate our people as to really what this is all about. Because, you see, we pay an ignorance tax. That's our problem. We are paying an ignorance tax by not knowing things. And we are suffering as a result of it. And that's what, you know, we'll be announcing tonight at 5:30. And we'll be moving on from there. And hopefully by Saturday, you know, we can really come to grips with at the Brooklyn Christian Center in Brooklyn to really address how do we overhaul this criminal justice system, and how do we get large numbers of people out of it? Because we plan to bring a whole lot of people home. Okay, that's what the point is. We can't rebuild families if men are behind bars, and they are telling us that you can now have same-sex marriages, you know, which is an excuse. So we're looking up there and say, well, you know, I don't really need a man now, no more. I can have a marriage with a woman. Well, you can, and I'm not saying whether that's right or wrong. That's for you to decide. But what I am saying, you can't reproduce. I mean, I can tell you that, and I don't think nobody can argue that. Now, if you want to forego the reproduction process, you know, then you're talking about a total genocide of the race, all right, because you got to be able to reproduce. Now, whether, you know, you in any particular individual want to reproduce or not, is that person's decision. But for you to think that now I can leave all these men behind bars because I can have a same-sex marriage, I mean, it's ludicrous. And that's what this is all about.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us again today and for adding some more light to this question about the legal lynching of the Central Park 7. Not the 5, and I think we established that there were 2 others. And to give us some more information about where you are headed next. Thanks, Alton, for being with us today. I really appreciate it.
And thanks for the invitation, Dries.
Thanks. And just a reminder, it's tonight at the library on 124th between 5th Avenue and Malcolm X Boulevard at 5:30. Thanks, Alton. Also tonight, I just got a note from Dr. Gerald Horn. You may remember that Dr. Horn is a frequent flyer with Lead Stories. He is having a book launching in Brooklyn tonight as well. The last book that we talked about, The Counter-Revolution of 1776, Slave Resistance and the Origins of the USA, that is being launched tonight in Brooklyn. As well as Race to Revolution, the U.S. and Cuba During Slavery and Jim Crow. That is at Sister's Place at 6:30, and Sister's Place is at 456 Nostrand Avenue at Jefferson Avenue in Bedford-Stuyvesant.